The views expressed on Skeptically Speaking do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the University of Alberta, the Students' Union, or CJSR.
Hello, and welcome to Skeptically Speaking, the show that asks you to call in and question everything. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and today we'll be talking to Rachel, Dr. Rachie Dunlop, about being a skeptical activist and scientist, and also why the two seem to be more mutually exclusive than we would like. So let's start out the show with something completely different. We had a video sent to us this week. Why don't you tell us about that?
It was apparently an image of Bigfoot. It was actually pretty impressive. They got a pretty good shot of him, even a nice like facial there. He kind of turned, you know, thoughtfully to look towards the camera before he passed behind the trees, after which, of course, he was completely untraceable. Pretty impressive, I'd say. Definitive evidence is in. There is a Bigfoot civilization just out there. Just
really?
Beyond the trees. No. Yeah, absolutely. Because it actually works with the theory of my friends. He was explaining to me how it's entirely possible there could be an entire civilization of big feet people out there, as long as Bigfoots are basically naturally ninjas. Because we have ninjas. If people can be ninjas, Bigfoots can be ninjas. That's just logical. So if Bigfoots are ninjas, which we don't know they're not.
You know, you took something completely different away from this video than I did.
I guess so. What did you...
I thought it was quite an obvious fake, actually. This, my friends, everybody listening, this was a Bigfoot video, and it was very, very clear, extremely clear. So clear that Bigfoot at one point looked over his shoulder back at the camera. So that would be my first...
Well, that's one way you can go,
okay.
I guess. Yeah.
But also, there was definitely a dramatic chipmunk moment there. For a moment, it was great. If people don't know what dramatic chipmunk is, please do Google it. But I wouldn't say that there was any reason to think that was real, Mike.
Well, that's what I'm going with. And I, for one, welcome our new Bigfoot overlords.
I knew that was coming.
Yeah,
actually.
You did. Yeah.
Yeah. Mike and I are talking about the same video for everybody that would like to know about that. All right. So I'm just going to say for the listener who sent that in and wanted our opinion of it, I'm going to have to give it a that's not Bigfoot. Perhaps a furry out for a walk. Don't judge.
If so, looking good.
And Mike, you're going to go with?
First definitive evidence of Bigfoot civilization.
All right.
Yeah.
So we are on the line with Steve Toms. And Steve, are you there? And now to Speaking Up. If you were listening to the live version of the show, you know that we attempted to have Steve Toms, editor of Skeptic North, the pan-Canadian skeptical blog collective, on to talk about the project. But the internet is a harsh mistress. He had some computer issues, and the segment unfortunately had to be scrapped. But luckily, I know a bit about the blog, so let me fill you in on what you missed. A long time ago, in a land far away, there was a skeptical conference. This wondrous gathering was called the Amazing Meeting 7. Skeptics from all across the world came together to share news of their homelands, to discuss common skeptical issues, and to learn from one another. And so it came to be that there was a meeting of regionally related minds, the Canadian Contingent Meetup. For these skeptics, some separated by hinterland, others by mountains, some relegated to remote islands, this was finally the chance to meet their brethren, to embrace them. And so there was embracing, in the exchange of email addresses, and the eating of pizza. In their charming accents, they spoke of crystal healers in Vancouver, the creationists of Alberta, organic food in Ontario, and cancer-curing cannabis in Nova Scotia. And they drank substandard American beer. And it was good. But after TAM, and back in their respective provinces, they realized they wanted more. They were not content to simply know of each other's existence. No, that was not enough for this intrepid group of skeptical explorers. They wanted to make a difference. To spread reason and critical thinking to every corner of their beloved homeland. To banish ignorance and misinformation and expose those who would profit from them. like their Canadian foreparents, they could not succeed alone. They had to band together to fight the elements and the loneliness and the beavers. In this case, beavers refers to unproven alternative medicine, Raelians, e-meters, and the anti-vaccination movement. So, they began a blog. And so it was named in that amusing but vaguely self-deprecating Canadian way, Skeptic North. With contributors from sea to shining sea, Skeptic North set out to make their mark, not only on the skeptical community, but also on mainstream media. Day and night, they toiled, researching and writing and honing both their snark and their ability to critically analyze the world around them. They published post after post challenging pseudoscience across Canada. They explained patiently and with quiet humor that magnetic fields don't actually affect human health. That correlation and causation mean two totally different things. That energy healing actually involves neither energy nor healing. That all natural describes arsenic just as well as an all-fruit smoothie. That Jenny McCarthy's mommy instincts are not comparable to a medical degree. And then suddenly, the unthinkable happened. The specter of naturopaths with the ability to prescribe actual medication in Ontario reared its ugly head. And Skeptic North rallied the troops. They wrote and they wrote as fast as their little fingers allowed. And lo and behold, the mainstream media took notice. Newspapers and websites and radio programs started calling, and they wanted to talk about skepticism. And Skeptic North told everyone who would listen about the potential danger of giving prescriptive powers to people who believe that the vibration of water can cure illness, or that coffee enemas were somehow beneficial, and how this was actually a very, very bad idea. But to no avail. With only as much warning as three readings of a bill would allow, the deed was done. The government of Ontario had given its blessing to the naturopaths, changing its laws and giving them prescriptive powers that had previously been reserved for professionals with actual medical training. And Skeptic North was sad and wanted to be where someone loved it best of all. Sweden, perhaps. But then, I heard voices. The voices of other skeptical Canadians, and skeptical Australians, and skeptical Americans. And they whispered to keep going, to keep on fighting, because the struggle would continue. Peddlers of pseudoscience and proponents of preposterous panaceas would persist. And only together could the brave skeptics hope to defeat them. But Skeptic North knew it needed help. It needed writers of all shapes and sizes, with specific areas of expertise, or not. Writers that could commit to providing quality content on a semi-regular basis, and who would be willing to send an email to Steve Toms at skepticnorth@gmail.com with a sample of their writing. And it needed readers. Readers who would comment on the blog in a mostly civil way, who would add the RSS feed to their readers, who would forward the links for the love of science and post them on Twitter and Facebook, and add them to Dig, Reddit, and even Bark.com. Where are these heroes, she asks? And will they step forward to join the struggle? To challenge the fallacious, the fraudulent, and the flippin' ridiculous whenever and wherever it emerges within Canada? Find out at skepticnorth.com. Most of this is true. And pretty much what Steve said on air. Mostly. And we'll be right back with Dr. Rachie, scientist and skeptical activist, right after this.
You are listening to Skeptically Speaking, thanks to the wonder of podcast technology or the generosity of one of our rebroadcasting stations. Skeptically Speaking is broadcast live out of CJSR 88.5 Edmonton, Alberta at 6 p.m. Mountain Time every Friday. If you're not in Edmonton, you can still listen to the broadcast live in our Ustream.tv feed, which you can find by following the Listen Live link on our website at skepticallyspeaking.com. You can also participate in the chat room and submit questions. During the week leading up to each show, you can find information on the upcoming episode and guest, and submit a question to be asked on the air. You can also subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. Our deepest thanks go to the stations that donate their valuable airtime to our program, including
Citywide LP 99.1 in Madison, Wisconsin, CILY, Kootenai Cooperative Radio, 93.5 FM in Nelson, 96.5 FM in Crawford Bay, and 107.5 FM in New Denver, British Columbia. CIVL, 101.7 FM in Abbotsford, British Columbia. CJAI, Amherst Island Public Radio, 92.1 FM in Stella, Ontario. CLHI, Rosslyn Radio, 101.1 FM in Rosslyn, British Columbia. Freethought Radio, and WPRR, Public Reality Radio, 1680 AM in Grand Rapids, Michigan.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and on the line is Dr. Rachel Dunlap, reporter for Australia's Skeptic Zone podcast, blogger at The Skeptics Book, and research officer at the Heart Research Institute in Sydney. Hello, Rachel. Thanks very much for being on Skeptically Speaking.
Hi, Desiree.
So you're a prominent skeptical activist, but you're also a working scientist. And when I think of you, if you'll forgive me, I think of you in a respectable white lab coat during the day, and then by night you put on a costume and you roam the streets protecting Australia's citizens from pseudoscience and scams.
Yeah, but don't tell anyone that. That's a secret what I do at night.
No one listens to this show anyway. It's fine.
Oh, okay. That's okay. Fine. No, that is true. I do spend my days in a white lab coat. And by night, I do troll the internet, actually, and just find if, you know, someone's wrong on the internet. So I can blog about it and tell them that they're wrong, basically.
So how much of your work days is actually spent in a lab working with specimens?
All of it. I do, as cliche goes, I do stand at a bench in a white lab coat, and I spend all my days doing research, and I mainly work, most of my work is about heart disease, as you mentioned, but also I work in aging disorders. So I look at Parkinson's and Alzheimer's and a disease called ALS, which is known as Lou Gehrig's disease in the United States, which is a motor neuron disorder. And I'm currently doing some very interesting work with a group in Wyoming in the States, trying to establish the cause of Lou Gehrig's disease. And that's really exciting. And we're writing a grant for that at the moment. And we're hoping to get some money so we can do some more research. But yeah, I do. I spend all my days. And in fact, I must say, Desiree, my lab coat is blue. It's not white.
Is that regulation?
It is, because in our institute, we have three areas of sort of confinement, if you like. So there's the areas are more secure as you go up in terms of, you know, the biological threat, I suppose. Mm. And in the sort of low threat area, the lab coats are white. In my area, which is called PC2, the lab coats are blue. And in the radioactive area, they're bright pink.
Well, that's unfortunate.
No, they're actually quite nice. They're quite pretty. In fact, the stuff I do with Richard Saunders, we do a school show for kids, which we might talk about later. Mm-hmm. We're probably going to get ourselves a blue one and a pink one, and I'm going to make Richard wear the pink one.
You've just made my day.
I thought so.
So working in a lab, I'm just wondering, how difficult is it to design an experiment, like to build in the right controls and to make sure that it will be accepted as a valid study at the end of it all?
It's not really that difficult if you are trained properly and if you know the rules and if you know the scientific method very well. I'm lucky in that I do a lot of work in the peer review process. So I get papers from people that are submitting them to journals, and I get to critically analyze them and look at where they've done the right thing or the wrong thing. So that gives me a very good idea of what is required. So as long as you know the scientific method, and if you understand how you would write it up and how you would be able to explain it, then it's not that difficult to work that stuff out. And of course, I've done a PhD, so I've written 400 pages of explaining how experiments work and what is a good control versus a bad control. So I've had a lot of experience in that. So once you've got to a level where you've got a PhD, you've pretty much got that down pat. And if you haven't, then you've gone wrong somewhere.
So how does that affect the way that you see a lot of the more poorly researched, or sorry, more poorly designed research that may come out of something like the alternative health industry?
Yeah. I mean, this is a thing that's so helpful for me in what I do with the Skeptic Zone and with my podcasting and my blogging, because in fact, just before you called me, I was reading a statement from Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy about this Wakefield study that was retracted by The Lancet last week. And they cited another study that he did, this published in 2009, actually, and it was in macaques, which are monkeys, and it was looking at neurological development after they'd had a vaccine with thimerosal, which is the mercury-containing component part of some vaccines. And I might emphasise that it was taken out of all childhood vaccines in the US in the year 2000, mind you. Mm-hmm. So I'm not quite sure why he's doing a study looking at the impact of thimerosal anyway. However, I read through that study and because of my experience as a scientist, I was able to spot straight away that he hadn't used a vaccine that had thimerosal in it. Instead, he got a vaccine and put thimerosal in it, which to me seemed a little bit unusual. I mean, you can still get vaccines with thimerosal in them, so there's no need for him to make one up. So I thought that was a bit unusual. And the other thing you should always look for, and this is a really good thing for everyone to remember, is look for the conflict of interest statement in papers. Now, I've had a huge argument over the last few days with a few people on my blog about how scientists get paid off by Big Pharma, and you know the story.
Yes.
I mean, it's so boring now, I'm not even going to talk about it. But they claim that, you know, we have a conflict of interest, but every time you publish a scientific paper, you have to reveal your conflicts of interest. Mm-hmm. And this is one of the reasons why Wakefield's paper was brought into disrepute initially by Brian Deer, the investigative journalist from the UK, because it turned out he had conflicts of interest that he hadn't disclosed. Now, on this particular paper that Jim Carrey and Jenny McCarthy are citing as breakthrough study that, you know, is trying to be quashed by Big Pharma and big government, well, if you read the conflict of interest statement, you'll see that two of the authors have cases going through the vaccine injury court in the US.
Interesting.
One of them was an expert witness, I think, in the omnibus cases, which was the trial cases to see if vaccines cause autism, which eventually got thrown out. And Wakefield's on the paper. Now, I think we all know his conflicts of interest. So it was also in a quite low sort of important journal. It wasn't a very important journal. It was quite a small journal. So when you look at that and you consider those things, you think, well, okay, I will still look at the study, but that to me straight away rings alarm bells to me, you know? So,
and maybe people that aren't as educated in this area as you would not have the forethought to look at that paper and know what the warning bells were, the red flags.
I'm glad that you said not as educated and with as much forethought, Desiree, because then I don't have to say that about Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey. I didn't say it.
Nicely put. Desiree nicely said. Put.
No, you make a really good point. And the other thing is, you know, when you see, for example, with the 1023 campaign that just happened last week in the UK, and of course around the world, we did it in Australia, and Kylie Sturgis, who's a reporter for The Zone, did it in Perth, and as a lot of New Zealanders did it as well. You know, the homeopaths went mental, as they are prone to do, and said that, of course, homeopathy works because look at this study from the Journal of Homeopathy. Okay, now that's another example of a bit of a conflict of interest, because if you see a study in the Journal of Complementary Medicine, and that is a real journal, and it's saying that complementary medicine works, well, you have to assume, and it's safe to assume generally, that the editors are sympathetic to complementary medicine.
Absolutely.
And probably the reviewers are working in complementary medicine. So in that case, you have to be very skeptical and you have to analyse the paper. It may still be correct, I don't know, but you'd want to put your red flags up, you know.
And, you know, just for the audience, because we definitely don't have an audience that is decidedly skeptical necessarily, so the 1023 campaign was?
Oh, right. Yes, the 1023 campaign was a campaign set up by the Merseyside Skeptics in the UK, and it was designed to demonstrate that homeopathy, there's nothing in it. Now, the relevance of 1023 is that that's Avogadro's number, which is when something is diluted to a point beyond which there is likely to be no original substance left, which is 10 to the power of 23. You can't have anything in the substance. And so what happened was a bunch of skeptics from all around the world, organised by the Merseyside Skeptics, got together on Saturday, last Saturday at 10:23 a.m. England time, and overdosed on homeopathy. Now, a lot of them did it in the UK outside a pharmacy called Boots as a protest against them stocking their own line of homeopathic medicines.
Right.
And many of them took sleeping tablets. And, in fact, in Sydney, when we did it here, we took sleeping tablets. And guess what happened, Desiree?
I'm going to assume it's not fell asleep.
No.
No.
Nobody fell asleep. No. Nobody got toxicity. Nobody overdosed. So I think everyone fell asleep approximately 12 hours after they'd taken the pills.
You know, that's convenient.
Yeah.
But, huh. And this actually, this was a huge media circus. It's fantastic. It's been written about everywhere.
It was amazing. The guys that organized it from Merseyside, they did a brilliant job, and they ended up getting some pretty heavy hitters supporting the campaign. The likes of Dave Gorman, who is a very well-known comedian in the UK. And they had press coverage everywhere. Not much happened in Australia because we were a little bit disorganized, and I apologize, we'll do better next year. But in New Zealand, there was a really interesting article written, which the headline said, "Homeopaths admit there's nothing in it."
I saw that article. That was great. That was brilliant.
That was great. That's actually Vicky Hyde, who is the sort of head of the New Zealand Skeptic. She was the one that organised the New Zealand arm of that campaign. And, yeah, they did really well. But what I thought was really funny was that some homeopaths, of course, they came out criticising it, and some of the things that they said to justify that you couldn't overdose on homeopathy included, well, you can't take it all straight away because it's about the timing of the dose, not the dose itself.
Right.
So if you don't take it like 3 or 4 days apart, it won't work. Then it got into the stuff about, well, it's not actually the active ingredient. It's, in fact, the quantum vibration, electromagnetic energy of the water. I'm sorry, I just made that up. No, I didn't.
That's
but
okay.
It sounds like
I did, right? Too.
This is what they were saying. And then so they just kept shifting the goalpost to, well, it's not about what's in it or not in it. It's about the fact that, you know, it's got these vibrations or it's got a memory or...
And something about personalization as well.
It has to be
personalized.
But I found that really interesting too, because by saying that, they effectively admitted that there is no use in buying homeopathy off a shelf in a pharmacy, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. However, it's everywhere. You know, it's endemic, and we have a huge problem with it in Australia as well.
Well, maybe if they were infighting instead, you know, the professional homeopaths versus the people
exactly.
who are just making homeopathy in their kitchens or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Maybe they could just keep themselves occupied.
I'd love to see them turn on each other.
Yes. Actually, we have a caller.
Okay.
Hi, is this Derek from L.A.?
Yes, it is.
Hi.
It's Derek Bartholomew, Jenny McCarthy body count guy.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm good. We had a very good week in the reality-based community, didn't we?
Oh, we did. I'm very excited.
I was just wondering, you know, a lot of the goodness that happened this week is because of your long work in dealing with this. And how do you get to stay so awesome?
That is
how
a fantastic question,
so awesome?
Derek. Dr. Rachey, why are you so awesome?
Oh, look, as Rebecca Watson said last week on SGU, I'm 10 kinds of awesome, okay? Not just awesome. that's very sweet. I work very hard, I have to say. I do. I mean, last night in Australia was Friday night, and, you know, people that are my age and of my inclination might be going to the pub perhaps on a Friday, but I came home and wrote my Dr. Rachey reports and edited it and recorded it and finished it about midnight, so... Yeah, every moment that I have, I work, I read, I research, I blog. You know, I'm on the committee for the Australian Skeptics. I'm on three subcommittees for that. I'm part of the Institute for Science in Medicine, along with Steve Novella and Dave Gorski and a few other people. I'm on the pro-vax committee of that committee. So the list goes on. I'm very busy, and, you know, it's worth it. It's so worth putting in the work, because when you do put in the work, things like this week can happen. And I hope at some point, Desiree, we're going to talk about the AVN.
Oh, absolutely. It's on my list.
Okay, good.
Yes. Well, thank you so much for everything that you do.
Hey, listen, I love your website. It's great.
Oh, thank and you.
Everyone who's listening should check out Jenny McCarthy. What's the URL?
Jenny McCarthy Body Count. And it's .com, .net, or .org. All of them work.
Everyone should check it out. And you'll notice that I have your widget on my blog. So anyone who's got a blog can get the widget for Jenny McCarthy Body Count and stick it on your blog, and it will tick over as to how many kids are injured from not being vaccinated and how many children die. It's a great idea.
Well, thank you.
Thanks very much, Derek.
Bye. Thanks, Derek.
So there are many working scientists, but very few who identify as skeptics, much less become as active as you have been. Because Derek's right, you've done tons of work within the community. So why do you think, as a scientist, that you've become more involved in the community and others haven't?
Yeah, other working it's a good scientists. Question. And it's a simple answer. It's Richard Saunders' fault.
Oh, really? Do tell.
Yeah. Is that it? Is that all I have to say? No, it is. My friend Richard Saunders, who is the vice president of the Australian Skeptics, and also a very, very active and very successful Australian skeptic who's been working in this field for a very, very long time. He set up the Sydney Skeptics in the Pub in Sydney about 6 years ago now. And I just turned up there one day and met Richard, and we just got chatting about stuff, you know, about skepticism and science, and he got me involved, and I just started to because of my science skills and my background, I was able to then critically analyze, you know, health claims and supplement claims and that sort of stuff, which is what I do now. And that's when I got involved. And to answer your question about why other scientists don't do it, I'm not really sure, except that it's a lot of work. A lot of people just want to, you know, do their job, go home, spend time with their family, and that's great. And why wouldn't they? Because, you know, although what I do is, I think, helps a lot of people, there's also a lot of stuff you have to deal with. You know, you get attacked on the internet and you get abused, and, you know, you're constantly defending your position. So it's not something for everyone. And also I think critical thinking skills, which is what is required to be a skeptic, is not something that is taught to you either at medical school or necessarily doing a science degree.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that you have to learn. It's not something you're born with. And I think scientists tend to sort of be more likely to have those skills because of the fact that we have to critically analyze our own work and other people's work as part of our job. But it doesn't mean that everyone has those skills. And if you are not made aware that that is sort of a field of discipline, if you like, then it's just going to pass by you. So I think it's also important to notice that a lot of people do still have the idea of what's the harm, you know, as Tim Farley from whatstheharm.net says, what's the harm? You know, I work with some people who are pharmacists, trained as pharmacists, and now work in research. And I've had long discussions with them about homeopathy, and they've said, well, what's the harm? You know, why can't people just take it? Why don't you just leave these people alone? And my position these days is less sort of apologetic than it used to be, because I've seen so many cases now where people have been harmed directly by homeopathy, for example. I mean, you probably remember, Desiree, the case of Gloria Sam. She was a toddler in Australia who passed away about a year ago, and her parents have just been convicted of manslaughter because she had severe eczema, And instead of treating her with steroids or hydrocortisone cream, which you normally would if you have serious eczema, they treated her with homeopathy, and she died. She got septicemia eventually, a blood infection, and she died. And they were convicted of manslaughter. So when people at work say to me, I'll just leave them alone, there's nothing wrong with it, well, no, there is, you know. So this stuff gets me really fired up and makes me really angry when that sort of stuff happens. And I can't let it pass me by. Other people can, but I can't now. And I'm hooked, and so that's what I'm going to be doing for a very long time, I think.
And I think most people are quite happy with that. You know, on this team, on the skeptical side of the team.
Yeah.
We actually have a question submitted via the internet. Go ahead, Ryan. Okay.
I wanted to know, how has your Skeptics book blog, of which I'm very fond, affected you? For example, has it given you new opportunities? Has it been enjoyable? Or is it more of a service that takes a lot of time and hard work to do, but you do it for others' benefit? That's from Lee from Winnipeg.
Oh, great. Well, hi, Lee. Thanks for enjoying the blog. I love doing the blog. In fact, I set up the blog with a friend of mine, Amanda, who doesn't really post very much, but she sort of does the technical part of it. She's also a reporter on the Skeptic Zone. And can I just give you a little brief history of how it happened, Desiree?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, do you remember Richard Saunders was on a television show in Australia called The One?
Yes.
Which was the search for Australia's most successful psychic. And that was about 2 or 3 years ago. And he was on a panel where he would judge the ability of psychics with another lady by the name of... I can't remember her name now. Anyway.
The blonde lady.
Yeah, she was the witch on the panel. So mm-hmm. She was sort of the sympathizer for the psychic side, and Richard was the skeptic, you know, guy. And at one point, Richard was analyzing someone's reading, and she got really cranky, and she turned around and said, "Oh, that's just excuse number 53 from the Skeptic's Book of Poo Poo." And I thought, "Wow, that's a great name for a blog." So it's, you know, it's funny, it's been going from strength to strength, and recently our traffic has just gone through the roof as a result of some things that have happened on the intertubes.
Yes, we will be speaking about that as well. Okay. This is a packed week. We have so much to talk about, honestly.
Yeah, but no, I love writing the blog, and, you know, part of the blog has been very, very important because a lot of it contains information about vaccination, and a lot of it is covering the story surrounding the death of Dana McCaffrey a year ago, in fact today, Canadian time, when the story broke about her passing away from pertussis or whooping cough a year ago. I covered all of that on the blog, and that is very important. And what I try to do, and Tim Farley from whatstheharm.net talks about this too, is I try to make sure that I tag my posts and do it in such a way so that when you Google something, you get my blog. And it's funny because one of my other blogs, I also blog for the Skeptic Zone, which is skepticzoners.wordpress.com. On that particular blog, my ear candling post has had over 33,000 hits.
Oh, brilliant.
It's amazing. And when you look at the statistics and look at the keyword analysis for search terms, every single, I think, except in the top 10 or the top 20, every single one except one or two is ear candling or earwax removal or hoppy ear candles or ear candling damage or something. So that means that people that get onto Google and Google ear candles are finding my blog, which explains that ear candling is dangerous and illegal in Canada, by the way, even mm-hmm. though apparently it's still still sold. They're still sold, I'm told, by Scott Guevara.
Well, it's actually illegal to sell them.
Mm.
I thought it was. It's not illegal to use them, per se.
Yeah, it's illegal to sell them for medical purposes.
Right.
Apparently, I think you can still sell them for entertainment value. And
is that what people do on Friday nights?
I don't know, but if your listeners haven't seen the video of Britney Spears getting ear candling, I urge you to look it up. That's entertaining,
actually. So we're here with Dr. Rachel Dunlap talking about her experience as a skeptical scientist. If you're listening live, call in with your questions at 780-492-2577, extension 1. You can email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. Okay, so we were talking before that about the fact that scientists don't necessarily want to be involved with the skeptical community, the formal skeptical community. And there could be a number of reasons for that, whether they're busy or it's hard, or some people have a negative impression of skeptics, actually, as I'm sure you know.
Yep.
But it's not just that they're not becoming involved in the community. They're not speaking out formally at all against pseudoscience. So why do you think that is?
Yeah, I know. I don't know.
I don't mean to make you frustrated, Rachel.
Why can you tell?
A little. But it's true. I'm just wondering, is it more of, you know, there's typically the view that doctors are uncaring and unfeeling. It is a widespread view. So is this sort of an attempt not to be seen as any more harsh than they're already seen? You know, if they poo-poo everybody's... I'm using your word. I swear I would never say that on air. If they negate what other people are doing, that the client or the patient thinks that it helps, even if it doesn't help, do they come across as even more harsh? And do you think that's part of it?
Well, I'm not a clinician, so I can't speak for them. But, I have heard stories from friends of mine who have, one of my friends who has a daughter who's a clinician, in fact, and there have been occasions when she has said to people, just go and get acupuncture because I can't help you. There's nothing Western medicine can do for you anymore. So there's a, you know, small placebo effect probably with acupuncture. And it has been shown to be effective in a couple of cases, by the way, you know, lower back pain and some minor headaches. So I'm not poo-pooing it totally. But there's a large placebo effect with those kind of things. I mean, everybody knows that. That's the same with going to a homeopath rather than buying it from the pharmacy, you know. So, in terms of speaking out against pseudoscience and why scientists don't do it more, I think you really need the education, as I said before. I mean, for example, when Richard Saunders did an expose of the power balance bracelets that you talked about last week with Scooter from grassroots skeptics, they had a scientist on there who's a professor from the University of Flinders University in South Australia, and he was looking at them all quizzically and sciencey and saying, well, maybe we need to do some more tests. And at some point, the producers on that show were telling Richard that they were going to get them analysed at a university using an MRI machine or something. And Richard's comment was, well, why do you want to break open a peanut with a jackhammer? They're useless. I mean, they're a bit of plastic. So sometimes scientists can be a danger to themselves in that way, because if you don't know the processes and if you don't understand the modus operandi, if you like, of these kind of things, then you can actually contribute to the problem. You know, it's like when James Randi tricked all those scientists into believing that, I can't remember the situation, whether it was, you know, this guy posing as a psychic or as a mentalist.
Right.
And scientists were saying, oh, well, you know, that's amazing. But they're scientists. They're not magicians. They're not skeptics. So they can't always tell. Scientists are humans like anybody else. So I often get calls from the media asking me questions about things like that. And I can answer those things because I understand how it works. But just because I'm a scientist doesn't mean I will know how it works. I have to be able to do all my work. I have to understand the background to it. I can't just speak out as a scientist. So that's probably why.
We have an email.
Yes, email is from David. He asks, I've been involved in organized skepticism since the early 90s, but became somewhat burned out in trying to deal with the people who just won't deal with reality. A good example is the nonsense statement you mentioned from Jenny McCarthy and Jim Carrey when they ignore the science and claim conspiracy, and people listen to them. Given all the work you do, how do you avoid being burned out on dealing with these sorts of idiots?
Oh, yeah. Well,
You're hurting me.
Oh, God.
No, do answer.
Some of it is so funny, though. You know, this whole stuff about the anti-vaxxers and their conspiracy theories is hilarious. You know, they believe that there's a new world order, an Illuminati that's organized from Berlin, and it has arms like a spider that controls the rest of the world, and there are microchips in chemtrails of planes, and they're spraying us at 3 o'clock in the morning to implant us with the precursor to the H1N. Do I need to go on?
No. No. Ow.
Like, seriously, this is true. I'm not making this up. But it turns out that whole story, and there's a lot more to it, and I won't bore you, Desiree, is written by David Icke. Now, listeners might remember David Icke. He's like one of the world's most famous conspiracy theory guys. Mm-hmm. You know, he believes that half the population, including the royal family, are lizard people in hiding, and they're here to control the population, and at some point they'll come out and take over the world and blah, blah, blah. But he's known as a nut job, and if you go to his website, you'll see some wonderful images of how vaccines are trying to kill everyone and take over the world. But it's funny. And when you dig this stuff up and you realize that people like Jenny McCarthy, and I don't know if she particularly prescribes to this theory, but I bet she's, you know, she probably does. The rest of them do. That's just when it becomes absurd, you know? Right. So when you get people on your blog saying, but you're a big pharma shill and you're a part of the conspiracy, you just point them, you know, in the direction of this conspiracy theory and say, okay, well, that's all right. You guys believe this, so you go and sit over there and don't bother me anymore, because how can I possibly take you seriously if you think half the population are lizard people?
And that's a very good point. Now, okay, someone, let's talk about AVN. Someone like Meryl Dorey.
Mm-hmm.
Now, she recently resigned from the Australian Vaccination Network. Is she one of these people who, did she actually resign, or has she just threatened to resign if not given a huge wad of cash?
Yeah, that's right. She's threatened to resign unless she gets, and may I please say, unless she gets an injection of cash. And that's what she actually said. See how funny this is?
Really? She used that word? She did.
In her e-newsletter, and this was pointed out to me by Phil Plate, she said, unless I get a large injection of cash, I can no longer continue.
You know,
That's the first time she's used that word, I reckon.
I don't think people need science classes. I think they need irony classes lately.
Oh, God.
There's a lot of irony out there.
Yeah.
It's just being wasted.
Yeah, Phil Plate said his irony meter exploded when he read that, and he blogged about it and said the same thing. And then after that, maybe she didn't say upshot. I may have used that in one of my posts somewhere, but so I've been trying to just place words that, you know, mean injection or shot throughout my posts about this hilarious saga, by the way. But anyway, sorry.
No. And you've done tons of work around the Australian Vaccination Network. Now, if Meryl Dorey, who has been a thorn in the side of science-friendly people everywhere for years...
I wouldn't give her that much credit, actually, but anyway.
All right. Good. You're an optimist. That's lovely.
No, I don't want her to have that much credit. Anyway.
No. Well put. So if she does leave, now is this kind of the beginning of the end for the anti-vaccination movement in Australia?
Yes, it is. In my opinion, it is. Because although she holds the position of president, she's actually the AVN. The organisation consists of herself and two assistants that just work part-time. I think maybe one is full-time, but they're kind of just the girls that, you know, do the computer work and answer the phones and stuff. There's nobody else that's the spokesperson for the AVN except for Meryl Dorey. So AVN and Meryl Dorey are synonymous. They come together. So if she goes, they lose their media spokesperson. And if they've got no one there that the media knows and that they're familiar with, then it's the beginning of the end as far as I'm concerned. I don't see how they can go on without her.
And how much credit do you think that the skeptics in Australia deserve for that? Be completely immodest.
All of it.
Very nice.
But I want to point out that the skeptics in Australia is an umbrella. It's not Australian skeptics per se, if you know what I mean.
Right.
There has been a huge amount of work done by a huge number of people over the last 12 months in Australia. Some of them are involved directly with Australian skeptics, and some are just independent people off the street who just had enough of this fear-mongering and misinformation spread by this vile bunch of people. Of note is a guy by the name of Ken McLeod, and he submitted a complaint to the New South Wales Healthcare Complaints Commission, which was a very well-researched and long document detailing every point where they have said or misquoted statistics, claimed things about vaccines that are quite clearly wrong, you know, like they cause autism and SIDS and shaken baby syndrome, right, and whatever else they can make up on the day. That complaint is currently pending. We expect to hear in about 2 weeks as to the outcome. There's another complaint to the ACCC from the parents of Dana McCaffrey, the baby girl who passed away a year ago today. That is also about the AVN and their misinformation, as well as their harassment of these parents after their daughter died.
Right.
I mean, that story is just heinous, you know. There's no excuse for Meryl Dorey calling up the New South Wales Department of Health and demanding to see the autopsy of a four-week-old baby girl.
I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Because she was of the opinion that the New South Wales government was saying it was whooping cough to scare parents into getting vaccinated. Now, that to me is just vile. And if you are that sort of woman... Okay, I don't even know what to say. So let's move on.
Okay. Actually, on that note,
Sorry. There's a guy here by the name of Daniel Raffaele, and he set up a Facebook group called Stop the AVN. Mm-hmm. And they've got over 1,500 members now. And he has been, instrumental in campaigning against them. But we've also just done a lot of grassroots work, you know, where if she gets on the radio or if she gets on the television or she's in the newspaper, we write to the newspaper, we call the station, we complain. And we've had a couple of wins in that situation where she was on our government broadcaster here, the ABC, mm-hmm. and she said some things about the H1N1 swine flu vaccine, and they were wrong and they were published by the ABC, and so we complained and they had an investigation and they deemed that they were at fault. So you just have to keep chipping away. And, you know, if I was in her position now, where she's got two complaints with the Healthcare Complaints Commission, she's got one with the Office of Liquor, Gaming and Racing because she operated for 2 years without a valid charity license. She's losing money. She's desperate for money. She's getting harassed everywhere. Her reputation has been battered. I'm not surprised she wants to resign, you know?
So are there anti-AVN parties going on right now? I'm just wondering if I'm going to start to see Facebook events anytime now.
There will be, as you said earlier, and you're correct, she hasn't resigned at this point.
It was very carefully worded, that statement.
You know, it was. But funnily enough, like everything else that she says, the whole e-newsletter was misleading because the first, you know, the headline said AVN to close down at the end of the month.
Exactly.
And then if you read the text, it kind of said, I might not, I might. And then the next day she sent another e-newsletter saying, oh, just to clarify, I'll only close down if I don't get money. And then she sent an email to her members saying, I demand you all give me $100 each. Okay, she didn't demand, but she said, I want $100 each from all of my members. Otherwise, I'm closing down. Nee, nee, nee. But then yesterday, she sent another e-newsletter with the headline, Closing Down Sale, with all her materials 20% off for the next 3 weeks until they close.
So that looks like that could actually be the end of it. Possibly.
You know, it's looking like that. But the thing that fascinates me about this whole situation is why haven't the big guys come in to rescue her, you know?
Well, and this took place right after the Lancet retraction. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if you think that there's some kind of connection there. But
it's a conspiracy.
Of course it is. Of course. Very nicely put. And actually, again, audience, we're here with Dr. Rachey, and we're talking about what could possibly, with any luck, be the end of the Australian vaccination network. Because if you say it three times, it might come true. If you're listening live, call in with your questions to 780-492-2577, extension 1. Email live at skepticallyspeaking.com or tweet us at Skeptical Radio. And we'll be right back with more right after this.
On the next episode of Skeptically Speaking, we sit down with the Independent Investigations Group to discuss their $50,000 paranormal challenge. Steve Muscarella, Jim Newman, and Spencer Marks will tell us how they go about putting claims of paranormal abilities to the scientific test. And on Speaking Up, Joey Habin, author of the blog Newly Nerfed, shares her thoughts on superstitions. Challenging the Paranormal, next week on Skeptically Speaking, Friday night at 6 p.m. Mountain Time, live on CJSR and at skepticallyspeaking.com.
Welcome back to Skeptically Speaking. I'm your host, Desiree Schell, and I'm on the line with Dr. Rachel Dunlap, Skeptic Zone podcaster, skeptical activist, and working scientist. And I just have to make a little announcement here. People that are listening in the chat room, let us know that the Vancouver Skepticamp is March 20th. And you can find out all the information about it, far more details than I have time to give you, at vancouver.skepticamp.org. So anybody who happens to use Twitter and is at all involved in the science or skeptical community has noticed the continuing and completely unexpected saga of you and the Shorty Awards. So can you attempt to briefly tell us what happened there?
Oh, isn't this hilarious? Okay. Excuse me, Desiree. Very briefly, the Shorty Awards are known as the Twitter Oscars. And basically, they're pretty much just a popularity contest on Twitter. What happens is if you have a valid and current Twitter account, you can vote for people. You can nominate people, first of all, and then it goes into a second round where that you then vote for them. And then the top six finalists get looked at by a panel of judges, and then they decide the winner. So it all sounds pretty innocuous, you know, it's just vote for people if you want. So a few weeks ago, I received a couple of votes on Twitter in the category of health, and I didn't know anything about the Shorty Awards. So I went and had a look at the website, and I noticed that a couple of alternative medicine gurus were coming first and second in the health category. One is a guy by the name of Mike Adams, and he runs a website called naturalnews.com. The other guy is Dr. Joe McCullough, and he runs McCullough.com. And these websites give you health advice and then say, you need a supplement, and oh, look over here, I sell it in my shop. So anyway, I tweeted that they were coming first and second, and a friend of mine and a few people got involved, including Tim Farley and Jason Brown, and decided that they should vote me to be number one. At this point, I think I was number 16. And PZ Myers, who is well known for pole crashing, as people who are aware of his blog Pharyngula would know.
Yes, there's actually a phrase. It's called to pharyngulate.
Yes.
He does this so well. Yes.
Yeah. Well, he decided to pharyngulate the shorties, and so he blogged about it. And then so within a few hours, I'd overtaken these guys by a huge margin, and I was sitting in the top position. And this is when, Desiree, it got really interesting. Now, Mike Adams, who was then relegated to second position, he got a little bit cranky. And so he sent an email to all of his followers and said, guys, please go and vote for me because this person who I've never heard of from Australia is beating me. And then so his votes went through the roof, and then all of a sudden he wasn't there anymore. He got disqualified. Now, we don't know exactly what happened, and it may have been vote stuffing, mm-hmm. but in any case, he was removed. And some people have been saying that he probably shouldn't have been disqualified because if his followers broke the rules, it wasn't his fault. But I think it's important to note that the Shorties made the decision and they made it based on the evidence that they had, and
absolutely.
So they wouldn't have done it unless something was really wrong. So I think that he was disqualified, and he obviously should have been. So in any case, so at that point, he went spare because he couldn't believe that this little unknown skeptic from Australia would be beating him when he has so many fans. And so he wrote a wonderful post on naturalnews.com called What Skeptics Really Believe. Now, if your listeners haven't read it, I urge you to go and read it because it's very, very funny. And it's been taken apart by the likes of Steve Novella and Aurak over at Respectful Insolence, and I think PZ had a go at it as well. Many, many blogs took it apart because it's so funny. But basically, you know, saying that we believe that all vaccines are safe, that we can receive as many vaccines as possible, and that babies under the age of 6 months must have antidepressants. And we believe that this was my favourite, we believe that the water in our toilet is the same as the water in a natural mineral spring.
I found that one particularly interesting.
It was, because, well, it is the same, isn't it?
But the entire diatribe was strumming.
Oh, yeah. And in fact, Aurak at Respectful Insolence blog wrote a great post about a burning straw man of crazy or something like that. So he did that. And then at this point, Joe McCullough, who was then coming second because Mike Adams was disqualified, he got a bit cranky too. So he wrote a post on his Facebook page where he has 64,000 fans saying that I was an unknown non-physician, overweight, big pharma wet dream. And I shouldn't be beating him. And can everyone please go and vote for him?
I would just like to point out to anybody who reads Mercola's site that Dr. Rachy was called an overweight Big Pharma's wet dream.
Yeah.
This is the kind of individual we're dealing with.
I'm serious.
I was horrified.
Yeah, but it got so childish because instead of him saying, okay, you know, obviously she's coming first, fair enough, whatever. He went behind the shelter shed at school and called me fat. You know, I mean, should we meet behind the bike shed and have a slappy hand fight? You know, it was just so childish.
I would actually pay money to see that.
Yeah.
Just so we're clear. Okay.
But the funny thing was, once this happened, a lot of his followers began to turn on him. Because he has, as I said, 64,000 fans on Facebook. And I betcha some of those people are trying to lose weight. And so some of them started saying, hey, come on, Joe McCullough, what are you, you know, you're stooping to this childish name calling. But all the way through this stuff, he was also saying, I don't care about this silly little Twitter competition. It's not important to me. But please vote for me. Please vote for me with Garana on top sort of thing. But also, inadvertently, or maybe he's just not smart enough to realise, he put my URL for my blog on his Facebook page and said, I urge you to go to this blog to have a laugh. And so guess what happened?
Oh, I bet your page views are beautiful right now.
Yes. So my web traffic tripled overnight. And I started getting emails from people who were McCullough supporters saying, I got this great one from, this lady was actually quite polite, but she was trying to have a dig. And she said, your blog is so full of hate. Why don't you just write about something you love? And someone must pay you to write this because it's so full of hate. And of course her inference was, I'm getting paid by Big Pharma, right? And I wrote back and said, oh, thank you so much. And I'm so impressed that you think my website is paid. That must mean that the content is very high standard and da-da-da. And she didn't like that. And then she wrote back a few days later and said, oh, I'd just like to tell you that Mike Adams has had lots of traffic over the last few days and, you know, his website's gone out of control. And I wrote back and said, isn't that sweet? Because so is mine, blah, blah, blah.
Now, where does this stand now? We have one more minute in the show. I want people to know.
Okay. All right. Voting finished.
Yep.
Voting finished overnight. And I am still in first place. So basically, I've won the voting round. And at this point now, it goes to a panel and they make a final decision. But Because of everyone who supports me on Twitter, and thanks to all those guys, we beat McCullough. And I can't wait for him to have a hissy fit now.
He will. You have struck a blow for science everywhere.
And I'm no longer a little unknown skeptic from Australia, you know, so.
No. And actually, there are so many questions here that we're never going to get to at all because our time is up. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks, Desiree. It's been a huge week in skepticism, and things are looking up, I hope.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you can find Dr. Rachie at skepticzone.tv or on her blog at skepticsbook.com. But that's skeptics with a C, not a K.
It can be with a K. It'll pick it up.
Oh, really? You're smart.
Yeah.
So you can find our website at skepticallyspeaking.com, as well as links to our Facebook page, our Twitter feed, and to our iTunes link so that you can subscribe to the show. So thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week on Skeptically Speaking.